We now are joined on the Skype by curator Andrew Engel to preview the exhibition Video Freaks, The Art of Guerrilla Television, which will be on view at the Dorsky Museum of Arts at SUNY New Paltz February 7th, next Saturday, February 7th, through July 12th, 2015. The exhibition surveys the history and mythology of the Video Freaks, a collective of artists, storytellers, and activists who produced and disseminated alternative media across New York and other communities during the 1970s. They lived in Greene County in the early 1970s and produced Lanesville TV, perhaps the first pirate television station in the United States. The Video Freaks exploited the new technology of portable video as an emerging medium for creative expression and as a democratic tool for disseminating independent points of view in a pre-digital age. By establishing the first pirate television station in the United States, the Video Freaks created a base for media education and training and an informal media art center hosting local and international visitors. On Skype here with us is now Andrew Engel. Andrew, can you hear us? Oops, no. Andrew, can you hear us?
I can hear you, Tom.
Oh, now we can hear you.
Having me.
Great, now we can hear you. Great. Thank you for joining us. Where are you at today, Andrew?
Where am I today? I am indoors where it's warm in New York City, in Washington Heights.
Oh, great. Tell us about the show, first of all, at the Dorsky Museum at SUNY New Paltz, February 7th through July 12th. What exactly is Video Freaks, the Art of Guerrilla Television?
Sure. Well, I should add that this exhibition is the first retrospective of this pioneering collective. It of course, includes newly restored videotapes that the Video Freaks produced both in New York City and in Lanesville and Greene County between 1969 and 1978. But I think what makes this show special is that it's while the videos are the core of the exhibition, we also have uncovered some amazing, never-before-exhibited photography, 35-millimeter slides on a carousel projector, and over 80 objects, including drawings, prints, ephemera, publications by the Video Freaks, including the famous Spaghetti City Video Manual, and also some of their historic audiovisual equipment that we uncovered at SUNY New Paltz. Maybe I should just go ahead and tell this story, which I think is wonderful and poignant. There were 10 core members of the Video Freaks. Nine are living. Chuck Kennedy, who was the Video Freaks' chief engineer, he lived in New Paltz after he left Lanesville, and his last job until his death was at SUNY New Paltz at the Center for Student Media. So when I met with Daniel Belasco, who is the curator at the Dorsky, and it really was his idea and his vision to mount an exhibition like this at a museum that's focusing on Hudson Valley artists, he thought it would be wise to go visit Bill Clark, who is now the director for the Center for Student Media. And we made an appointment.
He runs a media center at the college?
It's the Center for Student Media is essentially their radio station and their campus cable TV station. So we wanted to meet with them to see what kind of resources would be available for the exhibition, because the Video Freaks were all about engagement, and it was important for us to involve students and faculty and staff with this project. So we made an appointment with Bill, and we walked into his office, and there on his shelf were two CV early video editing decks with the stencil on them saying Video Freaks. This was quite a surprise. Chuck Kennedy, who had passed away, who I'd mentioned before, was the chief engineer of the Video Freaks, and he left behind these decks. So we are including them in the exhibition so that visitors can see what kind of tools the Video Freaks were working with. And these were the actual tools that they were working with.
And I guess some of what's important about the Video Freaks, I guess, is that they arrived at the exact moment in time when video became portable and tape recorders became portable and things became a little bit smaller. I guess they were still these things that you found are still kind of much larger than the things that fit in our pockets today.
Yes. Tom, the term portable video is relative depending on what generation you're coming from. So for the Video Freaks, when Sony introduced the half-inch open reel Portapak in 1967, this was mind-blowing for people to be able to carry on your shoulder this 20-pound deck. You have your camera that plugs right in. And this was revolutionary for people to be able to move around and go to demonstrations, go to art events, and really get intimate with your interview subjects. That's what the Portapak allowed people to do. And this is something that we completely take for granted today with our iPhones, is that you could watch the video instantaneously, immediately. Prior to that, with 60-millimeter film or Super 8 film, you shot your film, you didn't really know what it's looking like, and then you send it to your lab and you get it back, and that's that, and it takes time. Here, you can build instant trust with your interview subjects by playing the video back for them and giving them a sense of what they look like.
And then
the video freaks were also best known for handing the camera back to their interview subject and allowing them to shoot as well.
Yeah, that's I was going. This was at the time a very expensive. It was cutting edge, you might have seen some of the reporters, I guess, in Vietnam with something like this, and at the protests around the country. But it was only in the hands of a few, I guess, elite gatekeepers at the time, and the Video Freaks were the first group that sort of turned that on its head.
Absolutely. And here's the local story behind this is that the Video Freaks' origins were at the Woodstock Festival. That's where we begin the story there. Two of the Video Freaks were there at the festival with their portable video equipment, and they found each other, and they decided to join forces.
How did they get that video equipment at Woodstock? Was this CBS involved at this point, or?
No, CBS was not involved at this point. Both Video Freaks were able to procure their own equipment through their own networks. Not many people were using these portable video cameras back in 1969 because, like I said, they were only introduced a few years early. But naturally, they were drawn to each other when they found each other at the festival. And unlike, the famous Woodstock film, which covers mostly the concerts that took place, in typical fashion, the Video Freaks went behind the scenes. They were taping the first aid tents where people might be tripping and having bad acid trips, and they were interested in how they were being treated. So we'll have an excerpt of this very peaceful vegetarian man cradling a lamb in his lap, talking about how he cares for people on bad acid trips. These two Video Freaks, it was Parry Teasdale, who now lives in Columbia County.
And our listeners probably know him better than anybody else involved in this story, as he's now the editor of the Columbia paper in Columbia County up here, and so is a prolific newspaper writer.
Yes, and prior to that with the Woodstock Times. So Parry joined forces with David Court, and David Court's partner at the time, Curtis Ratcliffe, Mary Curtis Ratcliffe. And the group started to grow when CBS hired them to produce the legendary Subject to Change pilot presentation that was intended to document the counterculture of the U.S. at the time.
And this is literally the meeting in the movie Network actually happening in real life, like 8 years before the movie came out. That was like 1976. You know what I'm talking about? When they had like the Black Panther group, they're giving cameras to, and the network is trying to find radicals to get big ratings with the counterculture.
Yes, absolutely. This youngish. Well, I mean, to say he was 40, 39 or 40. This gentleman named Don West, who was the assistant to the CBS president at the time, realized that the network needed to catch up and document what was going on with youth in the late 60s. So he had this idea to create a magazine, TV magazine program on the counterculture. He had heard about the Video Freaks from a guy in the mailroom at CBS named Lou Brill, who knew David Court, and Lou Brill arranged a meeting, knowing that Don West wanted to do a program, and he needed the right individuals to realize this vision. So they met, they were hired. The Video Freaks received tremendous resources from CBS, equipment, tape, a live workspace, both upstate and in New York City to edit and complete the program. As the story goes, I should back up a bit, and I should refocus on the exhibition too. So what you're going to see in the exhibition is excerpts from Subject to Change, which was re-edited by Skip Blumberg, who is now head of the Video Freaks Partnership, which manages the archive of the Video Freaks, which is held at Video Data Bank and is involved with all matters related to the Video Freaks today, because it's going to be the year of the Video Freaks, as Skip likes to say. We've got this exhibition, which is opening a week from today on February 7th. Everyone is invited to come to New Paltz, to the Dorsky. It's between 5 and 7. In addition to the exhibition, there's also a film that is nearing completion that will be released this year, a documentary about the Video Freaks. So it's going to be exciting. So going back, I guess, to Subject to Change. So they received support to travel across the country. They went to Chicago and interviewed Abby Hoth, Yippies. This was his first interview for television. They also went to meet Fred Hampton of the Black Panther Party. They interviewed him, and this tape ended up not being included in the Subject to Change program. Shortly after this interview with Fred Hampton, the Chicago police killed him in his apartment in Chicago. The tape was perceived as highly sensitive, and out of respect for Hampton, it was not included in the program, despite the fact that Don West of CBS wanted it to be included. The Video Freaks refused. Perry Teasdale was going to pull the plug on the program because Don West had come up with his own edit of Subject to Change, including the Hampton footage, and done in a very manipulative, typically CBS style, typically corporate style, with the authoritative voiceover, which the Video Freaks shunned for all their productions. And it was known as a spectacular failure, this CBS presentation. They invited all their friends. CBS executives were sequestered in an adjoining loft to watch it, to watch the event, which included live music, multiple monitors. In the end, the executives told them, you know, this is not for us. The group was fired. Don West was fired, and thus the Video Freaks were fired. But these executives did admit that this type of programming was 5 years ahead of its time.
Yeah, does the program exist somewhere today? Can someone watch what CBS put on?
They can watch the entire recording of Subject to Change. Mixed in, as they did during the production, with this live music And it's available from Video Data Bank, which houses the VideoFreaks archive and distributes the tapes, which are slowly being restored.
And so is this known in television history as like one of the great, you know, like the David Letterman morning show or something, that the great giant errors? I mean, if people got fired because of the show, failure of the show, then it seems like it is sort of some sort of epic but what, I guess it seemed like an epic mismatch of CBS and the Video Freaks to begin with.
Ultimately, yes, it was like oil and water. But although people describe it as this spectacular failure, some of the Video Freaks would say that this is what really set them free. Now they inherited all of this fantastic equipment from CBS, and they could really pursue their vision for guerrilla television. You have to remember at the time, and, you know, it's difficult for all of us to remember, you know, some of us maybe are too young to remember, but there were, at this time, 1969, there were three commercial television networks. Cable was in its infancy, PBS was in its infancy, there were limited access for television, for independent points of view on television. So the Video Freaks weren't going to be passive consumers of television. They were going to make their own television. They were going to make guerrilla television.
And even in radio, the community radio movement was still in its infancy at this point, too. So no one had even said the words community and television together until the Video Freaks, probably.
Right. Am I correct, Tom, that FM really was birthed in 1965? Is that correct?
I think it was a little sooner than that, but these are the years when FM was becoming the freeform, interesting place that where you could do things. Yes, and the Pacifica stations were starting in the early 60s, and you know, Radio Unnamable and WBAI was going on overnights and things like that. So, but the community access part of television would just the amount of gatekeepers to get on the air at this time, like you're saying, there's only three networks. There's not 200 channels. There's only three networks nationally, and with the local affiliates that have some hours of a day, there's just no time when any normal regular person that wasn't a talking head could get near a camera.
Exactly. This is what made it so radical for them when they left New York City. They were a bit burnt out after a while using their loft space for screenings. They started to build an audience in New York City, but some of the Video Freaks said that they were losing focus. To really deliver television to the people, they needed to form their own TV station. And with all the busy airwaves in New York City, it was more practical to do it upstate. And what was made it even more practical was it was more affordable to move upstate. And at the time, visionary funders like the New York State Council on the Arts and Rockefeller were offering grants to explore this new medium of video and television. So the Video Freaks applied for a grant to do education workshops and training with video upstate. They moved up in 1971 to Lanesville, New York.
And how did they pick Lanesville, or why Lanesville, Greene County?
They were driving around the Catskills. They were already familiar with the Catskills because I think in East Durham, that's when they did some of their editing for Subject to Change. And they they happened upon this 17-room, clapboard-sided house. It was a boarding house run by Sam and Miriam Ginsburg, who were these Russian, Yiddish-speaking landlords. This was no longer an active vacation spot in this part of the Catskills. And here are these long-haired hippies coming to this town. But the Ginsburgs really fell in love with them. Sam Ginsberg himself was a former communist from the former Soviet Union, who probably hated Nixon more than the video freaks. So there was a real synergy between them. And it was there that they established their base to do their upstate workshops and training in video. They did workshops for historians. They actually incorporated under the name Media Bus. They didn't actually have a bus. They had a van, and they would travel across the strait offering workshops to historians, to students, anyone who was interested in applying video to their practice. It was called Maple Tree Farm, and it kind of served as a hospitality center for the video community, who people came from all over. I mean, they came from nearby. Dave Jones, who's best known as this master engineer and artist, he lived in Chichester, not far. And there were people further away. Down in the city, folks would visit them, but also they had visitors from Paris, from the island of Réunion. People wanted to see what the video freaks were doing in Lanesville and looking at this experiment in community television, which paved the way for public access that followed. And you can even make the argument, Tom, that young folks who were out at Zuccotti Park on Tahrir Square with their iPhones using social media are standing on the shoulders of the video freaks. This idea of net neutrality was really based in what the video freaks were doing. They wanted to make video and television more accessible.
And certainly it's fallen by the wayside, but public access cable television is a direct descendant, at least from the ideas of the video freaks.
Yes, absolutely. And it was D.D. Halleck who told me, who was the co-founder of Paper Tiger Television, that Lanesville TV served as a model for Paper Tiger.
And D.D. Halleck is another activist who still works to keep radio and television airwaves at least partially active by the public. What was the reaction in Lanesville to the video freaks? Were people interested? Were they annoyed? Were they apprehensive? What was the reaction to them moving?
It took time to build some trust. Eventually, the video freaks started to get to know their neighbors.
I'm guessing the word freak at the time was not a good thing in Greene County.
Yes, and maybe that was part of the reason too, to change their name to Media Bus rather than keeping the official name as the Video Freaks. They started their broadcasts in 1972 with the help of a guy named John Paul Ferraro, who I believe is still in Poughkeepsie, who helped them set up their antenna. And they also purchased a transmitter with money that Abby Hoffman gave Parry Teasdale for writing a chapter in Hoffman's Steal This Book. It was a chapter on guerrilla broadcasting.
Parry wrote the chapter. I have Steal This Book in the other room here, and Parry wrote the chapter on guerrilla broadcasting in Steal This Book?
I'm not sure if it was the entire chapter, but
and that paid,
much of the text.
And that paid, and it paid for the transmitter that
exactly.
allowed Lanesville TV to happen.
Yes.
That's fascinating.
Actually, it was Abby's idea originally that he wanted the video freaks in New York City to jam the commercial networks using this transmitter. That was Abby's original vision, but, you know, the video freaks, as always, pursued their own vision.
Was there ever an attempt or any experiment with using the transmitter in New York City on top of a tall building, I would guess?
No. Building trust was slow. Eventually, and I think what was an important feature of the broadcast, which eventually settled on Saturday nights.
Do you know what channel it was?
It was Channel 3. And eventually, I wanted to add that they always posted their phone number at Maple Tree Farm so that people could call in. You know, I guess in some ways the phone number was like the hashtag of the time, where you could comment on the program quality. You could what was really most important for the freaks to know if people were receiving their signal, because at the time it was hard to get TV in the Stony Clove Valley.
Cable still is.
It still is.
Lanesville is a very mountainous area, if people don't know, and it's not penetrable by radio signals often. So I'm sure they had troubles with that.
So yeah, so Chuck Kennedy, who I mentioned earlier, their chief engineer, was adjusting the transmitter and the antenna and the signal to make sure that folks could get it. They always called Doyle's Bar. I don't know if it still exists, but this was the local pub. It was kind of like one of the important receiving stations for Lanesville TV broadcast to make sure that the signal was clear. They involved residents in the community in programming, either as interview subjects, as performers. In some sense, Lanesville was a co-creator with the Video Freaks of the programming, and some of the more famous broadcasts that were excerpting for the show include the Lanesville TV News Buggy. It was a baby stroller that the Video Freaks were not using, and Bart Friedman took the stroller out onto the highways and streets of Lanesville, pushing his videotape recorder, the Portapak, in the buggy, and it was a parody of Action News. There was a car accident on this highway. Some farm animals were born. As Bart said on the program, with the Lanesville TV News buggy, sometimes peanuts, and it's sometimes shells. Sometimes you get a good scoop and sometimes you don't. Another beloved program of the Lanesville community was a tape called Harriet by Nancy Kane. Now, Harriet Benjamin lived not far from the Freaks in a trailer nearby, and Nancy Kane wanted to get to know Harriet. She just really found her interesting. Her life as a housewife was documented by Nancy over several months, recording Harriet getting her kids ready for school, preparing meals. At one point, Harriet was kind of performing. And at one point she says, no washing, no ironing, no cooking, nothing. I'm sick of Lanesville. I want to see something different. Goodbye, Lanesville. I've had 17 years of it, and that's enough. And she gets into the car, turns it on. Nancy is riding shotgun with her, and they take off on the road, kind of like Thelma and Louise. And Harriet is cackling, and she's free, and she's singing Roll Out the Barrel. And although Nancy didn't intend it this way, the video was embraced by the feminist community, and it was screened as part of the Women's Video Festival and at other festivals.
And what was I going to ask about? Let's remind listeners, if they just tuned in, that you're listening to curator Andrew Engel, and he's previewing the Video Freaks, the Art of Guerrilla Television exhibition that is opening February 7th and running through July 12th, 2015, at the Dorsky Museum of Art in SUNY New Paltz, and sort of tracking the history of official that they were the first pirate television, or I guess it's probably something that's hard to tell whether somebody did that before previously.
Yeah, I think it's hard to say, but certainly one of the first pirate TV stations in the U.S. and the world.
And so what was their reaction in the local? Did the local newspaper do a story about this, or was there outrage? Did the FCC ever get in touch to try to shut them down? Or
No, the FCC never pursued them, although, you know, in some ways, I think the freaks were kind of hoping to, like, push some buttons. The video freaks were under surveillance by the FBI at one point.
Have you guys done Freedom of Information Act searches, or is there like...
Harry Teasdale did that, and we have some of the FBI memos that are redacted on view in the exhibition that people can see.
And what were they worried about?
You know, these it was just kind of odd to have these long-haired hippie guys and girls in this community. It's possible that the FBI may have been aware of the Fred Hampton tape that I mentioned earlier, Fred Hampton of the Black Panther Party.
There's conjecture that the FBI or other government agencies had a hand in that, or were involved in the final days of Fred Hampton.
Correct. People can see that. I also want to mention that we also have in the Lanesville TV section this beautiful work of stained glass with the words freaks on it by a man who lived near Freaks, who was an artist. He was known by the freaks as Horrible Howard. He was a character on another one of the Lanesville TV programs. This was a kid show called The Buckaroo Bart Show. Horrible Howard was the nemesis of the show. Buckaroo Bart was a cowboy. And he, along with his sidekick, Sheriff John, who was the son of Harriet, who I mentioned earlier, Howard was always getting into trouble. Bart and Sheriff John always made sure that all was in order in Lanesville.
That's what I was going to ask did they do any dramatic shows, or if it was all kind of documentary or interview or news, or were they doing soap operas or westerns or Rip Van Winkle narratives for Greene County or something?
In order to build the trust with their community, the video freaks did follow closely with many traditional TV genres, like the Western, like news reportage. But they also slipped in experimental television. For example, people will get to see some of the more artistic projects that the video freaks did. They experimented with a special effects generator to create this reverse mirror effect and played around with that. So now and then they would sort of spoon feed some material that pushed the envelope.
And how much of the how many recordings are there from this era, and how long did they broadcast?
There are approximately over 200 broadcasts that the video freaks did in Lanesville, and they were broadcasting between 1972 and 1977.
And did they do? You talked before about all the other material in the exhibition. I'm guessing there's a lot of flyers and things like that. Did they do? How did they do publicity so they could people could know to tune in?
We have. To tune in, with a hamlet of 300 people, most people knew about the broadcasts. But in terms of flyers for outreach beyond Lanesville, we have several of them on view in one section of the exhibition, with wonderful graphics done by the video freaks. Many of the video freaks excelled not only in video, but also in drawing and painting. I think what was really special about the group was the diversity of skills. But what they held in common was, as Skip has told me, Skip Lundberg, a strong work ethic that united the group. And it's quite amazing that they sustained for so long, living and working together up in Lanesville.
Yeah, what eventually happened? They just grew apart as groups are wont to do, or
slowly some of the core members they gradually left for various reasons over the years, marriage, you know, a desire to raise children, a desire to pursue independent work. You know, it just had a natural lifespan, and I'm actually maybe we can bring. Tom, because I should add that we have this beautiful 186-page catalog that was designed by a Hudson Valley firm called Demo, and in it is your essay, Tom, about the parallels between the histories of Wave Farm and Lanesville TV and the Video Freaks, and maybe you could. I would love to hand this over to you to talk about that a bit.
Well, you joked before about or did not joke, but told the story about how Abby Hoffman or Perry Teasdale writing an essay about guerrilla television in Abby Hoffman's Steal This Book paid for the transmitter that for the illegal transmitter or the pirate transmitter for and I always joke that our first the first transmitter from Free 103.9, which is the Wave Farm's first name parent organization, and that started as a pirate radio station in New York City in 1997. I was actually part of a pirate radio station in Tampa, Florida in 1995 called 87X before that. But the transmitter that we got in New York City for Free 103.9, I always joked that Rupert Murdoch paid for because I was a freelance music writer for the New York Post at the time, and doing that to get the money to buy a transmitter. And so I always joke that Rupert Murdoch. So that's the exact opposite, actually, of Steal This Book paying for a transmitter. Yeah. But I guess Free 103 started as a pirate radio operation in the 90s, and there were thousands of other pirate radio, or we called them microcasting stations in the 90s, who were kind of united in our civil disobedience, although in a number of many different ways, to allow access to the airwaves for community members, since the FCC had no regulatory scheme for under 100 watts of power. There was no way to apply for one or get a station, even though there was certainly ways to fit many smaller stations on the air and allow communities to have access, which is eventually the civil disobedience of the 90s led to two acts of Congress that have allowed low-power FM stations to be legal and proliferate throughout the country in a legal method. So I guess there's another similarity is that we had an impact in the 90s to create these laws to go through, and the Video Freaks had this impact in the 70s that replicated in all sorts of ways. To me, the public access cable television, which doesn't seem that important to society at this point in time. In the 80s, it really was, especially like in New York City, that still is a very active public access, lively forum for all different sorts of strange and interesting views. But at the time that the Video Freak started, no one had really thought about letting community members hold microphones or cameras.
Yeah, you know, I wanted to add too, Tom, that you know, you mentioned the FCC and FM radio and micro broadcasting. When Perry Teasdale left Lanesville and moved to Phoenicia, he was hired by the FCC as a consultant to draft a report on the development of low-power television and making that legal, and he used Lanesville TV as a model in this report.
Well, that's very similar to I'd say, this fellow Petri dish in the 90s, who was part of a group called Radio Liberty in Philadelphia that became the Prometheus Radio Project, which ended up working with the FCC to get these low-power FM bills crafted.
Great. And I should also add that your partner in crime, Galen Joseph Hunter, is going to be participating in a panel discussion at the Dorsky on March 8th with the Video Freaks. So I hope people will come to that as well as coming to the opening next Saturday between 5 and 7 at the Dorsky at SUNY New Paltz.
And is there anything special happening at the opening, or is all the Video Freaks going to be there that are remaining, or any of them? Or
many of them will be there. We're really excited about another opportunity for a reunion. You know, the Video Freaks have been meeting pretty frequently. I would say over the past couple of years, there was this symposium organized in 2013 by curator David Ross, who is has the honorific of being the first video curator in the world at the Everson Museum at Syracuse. So he has a long relationship with the Video Freaks, and he organized a symposium back in 2013 where the Video Freaks gathered. And since Video Data Bank began the archive for the Video Freaks collection, there have been more opportunities for the Video Freaks to get together, and there'll be more throughout the duration of the exhibition. We'll have other programs, screenings, and also I'm very excited that there'll be student presentations as part of the exhibition, inspired by the work of the Video Freaks. We already sent out a call for submissions, and people can check online for this. I think it's posted on the Hudson Valley Craigslist, the College Art Association, and I think Wave Farm also posted something about this, where there will be different themes. The first one is equality, and folks are invited to submit via YouTube their own two-minute video inspired by the theme of equality, and then during set times for the duration of the exhibition, students will do live edits of these videos and put them together for screenings in the galleries.
All right. And I want to finish up. We talked a lot about the real world impact of the Video Freaks and how they sort of ripple in their influence over the decades. But we didn't mention, the art world influence. What do you think is this exhibition meant to cement their place in the art world, or where do you think they are in terms of the art world?
I hope that's the case. I mean, for those people who do know the Video Freaks, they do associate Stick to Change, the spectacular failed pilot presentation for CBS, and they associate Lanesville TV. What I think is special about this show is that it will have a whole section of the exhibition called Art Scene, S-C-E-N-E, and Art Scene, S-E-E-N. And it's a section where you get to see art by the Video Freaks, video drawings. They participated in the first museum exhibition of video art. It was called Vision in Television. It was held at Brandeis University at the Rose Art Museum. They were participating along with Nam June Paik, with Stan Vanderbeek, Aldo Tambellini, major artists of the time. They were exhibiting, the Video Freaks were also exhibiting their work at The Kitchen, a very important downtown art center in New York City. And what I'm very excited about is we'll have the opportunity to exhibit a newly restored multi-monitor video installation by one of the Video Freaks members, Davidson Giuliotti. The piece is called Quaking Aspens. It's 20 minutes long, four projections, and it's a meditative piece featuring 40-second segments of different views of quaking aspens, the very popular North American tree that you find all around Greene County. And this was videotaped close to Maple Tree Farm.
And if anybody that just tuned in, we're talking with curator Andrew Engel, who has put together Video Freaks, The Art of Guerrilla Television, which will be on view at the Dorsky Museum of Arts at SUNY New Paltz, February 7th through July 12th. Anything else that we left out that we should mention for folks?
I should add just one more fantastic bit of material that we're including in the show. It documents the Blue Calzone, which was an inflatable video screen and tent that the Video Freaks designed with their colleague Pedro Lujan. And it was exhibited at Goddard College at a very famous event in 1970 called the Alternative Media Conference. We have newly restored tape of them blowing up the Blue Calzone.
It's a very famous conference for many in the alternative media circles over the years. That's known
as it was not only for video, but also for the underground press. Very important networking took place at this conference and information sharing.
Yes, you can see this.
So I hope your listeners will join us on February 7th between 5 and 7 p.m. It's going to be a lot of fun. Thank you, Tom, for having me.
And if not, the show is up through July 12th at the Dorsky Museum at SUNY New Paltz. All right, Andrew, thank you so much for joining us today.